Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is February 5th, 2009. The first item on the agenda is House Bill 2331. I will open a public hearing on House Bill 2331. Speaking on that.
House Bill 2331 would prevent a person who's previously entered a diversion program from being eligible for diversion on a second offense or a subsequent offense. We do not have a fiscal back on this, so it's just for a public hearing today.
Okay. Steve Dole, Brad Berry, and Rankin Johnson, please. Oh, I'm sorry, not Mr. Johnson, if you'd wait. Kevin Grant. Get three people up, if we could. And please go ahead in any order you wish. Just identify yourself for the record, please.
I'll start. Chair Barker. And members of the committee, my name is Brad Beer. I'm the Yamhill County District Attorney. I, too, chair the Oregon District Attorneys Association Legislative Committee. And this is a bill which we have proposed, which, as counsel has indicated, would limit a person's eligibility for a driving under the influence of intoxicants diversion to once in a lifetime. As you are probably aware, the current law allows a diversion for a first-time DUI offender, or would actually allow for another DUI diversion if a person has been conviction-free or diversion-free for a period of 10 years. This is actually a bit of an aberration in many of the areas where we look at first offenders and they are given a break. I'll take, for example, district attorney's diversions, wherein the DA may offer a diversion to an individual who's arrested on an offense, don't have any prior criminal record, and in fact the DA may exercise the option to give them a diversion on that once it's completed, the case is dismissed. That's the same with the DUII diversion. If an offender successfully completes the diversion, the DUII is dismissed. The diversion remains on their record for future reference because now we need to know whether or not they've had the diversion within the prior 10 years. The vast majority, and you're going to hear testimony of this, the vast majority of individuals who are arrested for DUII enter into and successfully complete a DUII diversion, never repeat the offense. Unfortunately, there are those who do, and many of those offenders who again repeat under a DUII are those that are not only obviously a repeat offender, but from our perspective, really are public safety risks. The current statistics on a person who's arrested for DUII, and again, I'm talking that is not the aberration. Current statistics, and I conservatively state them, is that a person has driven under the influence 100 times for every once they're actually arrested for DUII. We've had individuals that have had significant driving under the influence records and actually find themselves 10 years after their last conviction being eligible for a DUII diversion. And I won't take all the time. I have case after case where we've had individuals who have had prior DUIs, have a 10-year period where they're free, and then get another one and will go to prison. We've had some who are literally I had one this week in my office. They were eligible for another diversion by under 2 weeks from completion of the diversion that happened 10 years and 2 weeks before. What scares me much more and what ought to concern the public are individuals that, and I won't give you a name because this case is still pending in my office. I'll just refer to him by his first name of Charles. Charles was convicted in 1977 in both August and September of driving under the influence. In 1984, he was again convicted of driving under the influence. In January of 85 and in April of 88, he was convicted in each of those times of driving under the influence of intoxicants. Again in November of 91, October of 95, and March of 1996, he was convicted of driving under the influence. That is 8 convictions of driving under the influence of intoxicants, and then went on a break. And in June of 2007, was arrested again for driving under the influence of intoxicants, and by law was eligible for a DUII diversion, and in fact was granted a DUII diversion. He now, on September 6th of 2008, was arrested in my county for another DUII. A lesser aggravated one, a person we'll call Jerry, arrested in January of 99 for DUII. This is the one I mentioned a bit ago. On February 1st of 2009, again arrested for driving under the influence of intoxicants, and because of a 1 or 2 week period there is eligible for a diversion. Kathleen, in July of 1998, was convicted of two separate driving under the influence of intoxicant cases and again arrested in October of 1997 for a new DUI and, in fact, is now diversion eligible on a January 2, 2009 DUII arrest. What we see here as a public policy issue is that many people who get the DUI diversion really take it to heart and learn from that experience as a first-time offense. There are, unfortunately, many who do not. One more example I'll give you, and I couldn't remember the fellow's name, but I did the intake on it about 6 months ago, was a guy who was eligible for diversion, and his statement to the officer is, "I've been an alcoholic for 30 years, and his record proved it by a series of DUI convictions that were over 10 years old, and he too was eligible for DUII diversion." I just remind this committee that DUII, the issues around DUII are not treatment. The issues are people who choose to drink and drive. I don't have any problem, and I have actually told my community DUI diversions are a good thing for first-time offenders. It gets the attention of people who, in fact, make a mistake. It ought not to be a tool to avoid accountability on subsequent arrests for driving under the influence, and that should be for a lifetime.
Thank you. Any questions, Mr. Perry?
Yeah. Thank you.
Yes, Representative Olson.
I can wait.
Okay.
We'll
go to the whole panel in the last.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Steve Dole. I'm president of Crime Victims United. I'm a little bit out of my element today because, as most of you know, most of the time Ann Pratt sits here and talks to you about DUI offenses. She's the vice president of our organization and also a member of MAD. We are in support of this bill. I also should say that MAD will not comment on this bill because actually MAD does not support diversion. On the other hand, Crime Victims United does, but our point is that it should be one bite of the apple. In the last report, the last year that we have reports for, 183 of your fellow Oregonians died as a result of DUIs. Over 2,800 Oregonians were seriously injured because of DUIs. There is also about one-third of all drivers arrested or convicted of driving under the influence are repeat offenders, and these drivers are 40% more likely to be involved in a fatal crash than those without prior DUIs, and one out of three Americans will have an encounter with an impaired driver in their lifetime, according to MAD. There's a Maryland study that's entitled "Any First Alcohol Impaired Driving Event is a Substantial Predictor of Future Recidivism" by Roush. I quote, "Having even one prior alcohol-related event substantially and significantly increased the risk of a subsequent alcohol-related event, regardless of the way in which the event was handled, administratively, judicially, or through a diversion program." The study also found that a person convicted of a DUI had a lower recidivism rate than a person who entered and completed a diversion program. What do we wish to accomplish with this bill? We want to hold all offenders accountable by allowing only one diversion opportunity and by recording all intoxicated driving events. Diversion should be, as I said before, a one-time early intervention program that will prevent first offenders from becoming hardcore intoxicated drivers. Hardcore intoxicated drivers are not identified if they continue to receive diversion. A true record of the extent of each offender's problem is required by the court in order to guide the court to correct assessments, sanctions, and treatment programs. Granting diversion more than once has a problem in that the court does not know if the offender facing them is a true first-time offender. And last, diversion violations such as substance abuse, alcohol abuse, and driving while suspended need to be enforced by the courts. Diversion eligibility must also be adhered to. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, thank you for having me. My name is Kevin Grant. I am a member of the Governor's Advisory Committee on Driving Under the Influence of Intoxicants, and I am also a prior offender. I was arrested for, entered into diversion, and completed diversion just over 5 years ago. I was an abuser of alcohol and an addict of a different drug. And I am here to support House Bill 2331 so that offenders, including myself, cannot enter a diversion after a second or subsequent offense. Diversion is definitely a worthwhile policy that we have in the state. Many offenders, including myself, our actions are fueled by addiction or abuse. And for me, especially, the arrest was the only way I was going to get into treatment and turn my life around. Once treated, I had a clear head, and I was able to make that clear-headed decision to never do this again. Not in the next 10 years, but ever in my life. Why do we even have it available every 10 years? My understanding is that when this law went into effect, originally, the DMV had and other agencies had technological inadequacies to be able to track these kinds of things for longer than 10 years. I really don't see any public purpose today, certainly no public safety purpose today in having this rule. I believe that your second or subsequent offense, whether 1, 10, 20, 30, 40 years later, I believe these people have made a decision to commit DUI, for they've been treated, and they deserve a conviction, just like they would for any other crime they commit. I'm fortunate to have been able to enter into diversion. I don't have a conviction on my record. It doesn't affect me in my work and other parts of my life, and I believe I'm a better person for going through treatment. But I want to clear up that diversion does not equal treatment. Diversion is not the same thing as treatment. Treatment is always available after each offense. Diversion just dismisses a person's conviction so they can start fresh like I was able to. It's literally a get-out-of-jail-free card. I and other DUI offenders deserve treatment if we were ever get in trouble again with substances and driving under the influence. But I do not deserve another second chance to get my conviction dismissed. And this bill would still achieve both those things. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Rosa.
See, Brad or Kevin, either one of you can answer this question. Steve, I don't know if you'll, but you can chip in.
Probably not, Kate.
I'm just curious thanks, Mr. Chair. Are there any other states that are out front doing this right now, just one-time shot for diversion?
Chair Barker, Representative Olson, members of the committee, I don't know the answer to that question. It would be easy enough to find out. I'd be happy to get that answer for you.
Chair Barker, Representative Olson, if I may, it's my understanding through the information that I have, and again, I'm not certainly not the expert on this, but that there are 23 states in the country that have diversion, and that I think there's 8 or 9 that it's one time.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Wisnant.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Vaughn, you made a statement that you went through the diversion program, but what's necessary is treatment. And I guess my question is, if our diversion program is not working, maybe we need to look at the diversion program, too, if we're getting so many repeaters. It's not the purpose of this bill. I understand that. But, we maybe have identified a problem. We need to look at our diversion program. Could you comment on that, please?
Sure. Chair Barker, Representative Wisnant. I believe that that diversion does serve a purpose as the person next to me mentioned earlier, that it allows people who have made a mistake a chance to get out of their conviction so they can have a fresh start like I was able to. And I think that, as he mentioned, the vast majority of people do learn from that mistake and do not offend again. And so I don't necessarily believe there is a problem with diversion in itself. I believe that I'm a success story for that. But I just don't see any reason why anyone should be given a second chance after an arbitrary number like 10 years.
Thank you for those comments.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of questions, if I could. So how long ago was this law put into place? Do you know, Mr. Berry?
Chair Barker, Representative Shields, members of the committee, I would have to actually go back. I recall, and this is because it was when I first started practicing law back in 1980, we actually had a diversion-like program that then terminated, there was no diversion, and then it was reinstated about 1980 or 81, and I believe we've had diversion since that time. We've had lots of other changes that have kind of been ancillary to the diversion, I suppose, and required treatment and things like that, but not necessarily changes to the 10-year law. I might point out two things that go along with that. One is, with the reduction in the criminal level of driving while suspended, which was kind of the follow. Many people ended up with felony driving while suspended because they were multiple offenders of DUI. Those, the vast majority of those, now remain misdemeanors or violations on driving while suspended. The other side of that, though, this body in its wisdom created the felony driving while under intoxicants, 4 years ago, 6 years ago, and again, that would require a fourth conviction for DUI, three priors and now get a new one, which would be the fifth arrest for somebody who had completed diversion. And my point that I want to make there is if I got a felony DUI today, in 10 years, I would be eligible for diversion with that kind of record.
Gotcha. Can I ask a follow-up? So I'm trying to get a sense of whether or not we're trying to address a problem that we know is happening now or whether or not we're trying to prevent this from happening in the future. Do we have any sense of how many people have died at the hands of people who've gotten a DUI, you know, went through diversion, 10 years later got a second diversion, and then ended up committing vehicular homicide on somebody?
Chair Barker, Representative Shields, members of the committee, I don't have that figure, but if I might comment a little bit on that. In my county, and I speak from there because those are the cases I know, in the last year and a half, we have had two of the most tragic DUI death crashes that I'm aware of, and I would say nationally. As I mentioned to these folks that I just had the pleasure of meeting earlier, and you're going to hear from others, this is, I would respectfully submit, this is not an issue of those who are killed. There are many people who are involved in DUI crashes who are not under the influence. They're the subject of the person driving under the influence. And but for the grace of God, they go home from their little trip to the emergency room that night. They don't spend days there, or worse yet, they don't end up being buried by their relatives. This is a public safety issue, and with all due respect again to Representative Wisner, I think it's a good question, is treatment working? But this isn't a treatment issue. This is a public safety issue. Now, those stats, I'm confident, are available. To find crashes involving deaths may not be simple, just in how all of us DAs keep our records separately, and I'm not sure how DMV tracks that and would be able to. They do get suspensions for motor vehicle homicides, so they can pull those and see if somebody was available. But again, I would strongly urge the committee to recognize the public safety risk here, apart from the worst tragedies that occur, and that would be death. Thank you.
Questions from the committee? Mr. Chair. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A few questions about one thing. What's the relative financial cost of either scenario, and what's the relative safety benefit of either scenario? So what are the several questions related to that? What is diversion cost versus what is the additional conviction cost? Also, do we know the safety outcomes, the reduction of future accidents, you know, from going through diversion a second time after 10 years, after 20 years, after 30 years, 40 years, versus not going through diversion, versus having the other conviction? Do we have any of that data?
Vice Chair Wisnant, Representative Smith, members of the committee, I'm going to have to process your questions a little
bit. Sure.
The relative costs, I think, if we're talking to a state as a whole, whether or not we say in 11 years I pick up my second DUI and I get to go diversion, or I'm held accountable in the way of a conviction. One, in both instances, and again, this isn't a treatment issue, but in both instances, treatment is mandated by statute. Secondly, though, we have now a person who has offended again, and if they're allowed diversion, there is no other sanction which would be imposed. For example, work crew, community service, jail, if necessary. So what we're doing is allowing this second-time offender another, I think Mr. Bond stated it well, another get-out-of-jail-free card, yeah, just because they waited the right amount of time before they got arrested again. And again, and I candidly, I may be somewhat skeptical, but I think it is rare that a person gets arrested for a second DUI and they just happen to drive under the influence for the second time in their life. I just don't think that occurs. So my point being then, if in fact the treatment initially didn't take sufficient to teach somebody not to drive again, then a more punitive sanction plus treatment will hope the second time will teach them not to do it again. Because that's in fact what we do if they get convicted of the crime. Each time they get convicted of this, it is assumed that that punishment will increase. We need to do something to impress upon this person not to drink and drive. And ultimately, I suppose, a judge would say, you know what, Mr. Berry, you're in front of me for your third time in X amount of time. I'm got to weigh now on the side of public safety rather than worrying what's going to teach you a lesson. The longer I lock you up, I know you will not be out behind the wheel putting my community at risk.
Absolutely understand, and I don't mean to be—I don't want to be too utilitarian. I know to the family of somebody who's been injured or killed in an auto accident from a drunk driver, you know, the cost to the state is probably the least of their worries, and whether one course or another course is going to reduce crime and prevent crime over time is the least of their worries. And I totally understand that. And at the same time, in this fiscal picture, and as we worry about safety outcomes over time, I am deeply concerned about how we can spend our money the most smartly to create the most safety we can possibly create. And if we don't have the answer now, that's totally understandable. And if there's a chance to learn it soon about what the relative cost is of diversion versus non-diversion, you gave some version of an answer. But also, do we have any, and my guess is non-diversion is more expensive because we've got to lock some more people up, and that's legitimate, or can be legitimate. So then my question would be, do we know that it reduces that threat, or the fact that they're locked away, does actually reduce X number or reduce the incidence of future drunk driving injuries or drunk driving offenses greater in the future? And if we know that, it's great to know. If we don't, I'd love to find out.
Well, Vice Chair Wisnett, Representative Smith, members of the committee, I think it's clear that, in fact, studies will show that some punitive sanction has a benefit in reducing future behavior. I'm saying that across the board in criminal conduct. Candidly, I can't tell you specifically in a DUI incidents.
Thanks very much.
Grant, you had some comments?
Yes, thank you.
And I'd like to correct the record. I think I directed my message, but Mr. Grant answered very professionally, but my question was directed to Mr. Grant, and I appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you, Chair. Wasn't it Representative Smith and other members of the committee, just speaking as an offender, as I mentioned before, I know that if 5 years from now, or 5 or 6 years from now, if under current law I'd be eligible for another diversion, I can see how that might weigh into my decision whether or not to drive and drink. Knowing that 5 or 6 years from now I won't get convicted, I won't have to go to jail, I won't have certain penalties, maybe that would weigh into my decision. I can only speak as an individual, but I can see how others might come to that conclusion as well. Thank you.
Thanks. Thank you very much. No further questions from this panel. Thank you very much for your testimony. Steve, Mr. Dolietta.
If I may, Chair Wisnett and Representative Smith, this doesn't answer your question directly regarding cost, but I think this may lend some light to it. According to the National Safety Council and the National Highway Traffic Safety Commission, or Administration, excuse me, in Oregon in 2007, which is the last year we have these figures for, total estimated economic cost of drunk driving-related traffic fatalities was $181,500,000. Total estimated economic cost of crashes, including quality of life losses of alcohol-related traffic deaths, was $600 million.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Yes.
Just a comment in response to Mr. Shields' question about when the current diversion law came into being. I believe it was like 1983 in its current iteration. And witnesses have been correct about that. It was in response to some case law that had come down and created a terrific backlog of DUI cases.
Thank you. I just wanted to make sure that we'd had enough period of time beyond 10 years to get some analysis of whether or not this was a real problem.
Yeah. Okay. And the other part of that was correct, too. Part of the 10-year problem or issue was, and I only know this because was practicing back then, was it did have to do with DMV's ability to track and backlog and to be able to carry for and record-keeping their capacity, you know, and it was a more of a technological issue.
Thank you very much. Panel, thank you very much. Next, last, Ms. Teresa Douglas and Heather Kirby to please come up next. And as they're coming up, committee, you have written testimony. I got the names wrong. Jody Vaughn has submitted written testimony for your consideration. I think each member of the committee has that. And either one of you can begin, please, and please state your name and for the record, please, and
thank
who you represent.
Good afternoon. My name is Teresa Douglas. I'm a member of the Governor's Advisory Committee on DUAI. I'm also an alcohol and drug evaluation specialist, and I've been, we're also known as a DUAI evaluator, and I've worked in that capacity since 1984. I'm before you today in support of House Bill 2331. The diversion was originally, I believe, not only to clear off crowded dockets, but as a way of early intervention with folks that are doing this dangerous behavior. And I will just reiterate what the other folks have talked about, which is we are talking about people that have repeated this dangerous behavior. And just because they have waited 10 years from their last offense to this one, they are now getting to be treated just like the first-time offenders. These people are escaping all of the criminal penalties that go along with a DUAI conviction. They're not getting their licenses suspended by the courts. They're not on supervision. They're not subject to the ignition analog device. And they're escaping the criminal conviction on their driving record. The other thing that is not commonly known is that this statute does not require abstinence from alcohol or drugs during the period of time that they're on their diversion. And so the only way that we have to enforce that is through administrative rule. During the period of time that they're in treatment, they're required to be abstinent as part of their treatment. Prior to enrolling in treatment, and once they're done with their treatment, there is no requirement for these people to be sober. And I think that's a really important point. We're talking about repeat drunk drivers, intoxicated drivers, that are still able to drink and use their chemicals.
Thank you very much. Ms. Kirby, Mrs. Kirby, you want to?
Yeah, Mrs. Kirby. Hi, my name is Heather Warren Kirby. I'm a member of the GAC Committee on DUII. I'm also one of the owners of Acadia Northwest, and I'm here on behalf of support for House Bill 2331. I wanted to speak from the treatment provider's point of view in that it is significant when any one person is arrested for drinking and driving. Anyone who's arrested twice in a lifetime or any other significant event, that definitely is an indicator of an unhealthy relationship with alcohol or drugs. And it is that point in time when it is imperative that increased sanctions, increased treatment take place. With the diversion person, obviously, and we've heard about this, treatment does take place. I wanted to call your attention to some of the success rates in terms of there's a significant increase in success rates in treatment. According to NIDA, the National Institute on Drug Abuse, in July 2006, they put out a study that says if treatment lasts longer than 90 days and is included with legal consequences, and that's just for the first-time offender. Second-time offender, it's imperative that increased treatment and legal consequences take place. Diversion, whether it be 10 years, 15 years, we believe that lifetime diversion is significant. You know, it's arbitrary that it's 10 years at this point.
Thank you very much. Committee questions? Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. So when you said that they're not required to do ignition interlock, you mean the second time they're in diversion? Because we just passed a law last time that would require people who get their first DUI to have interlocks for a year. Is that what you meant?
Mr. Chair, Representative Shields, that's correct. They're only subject to the ignition interlock device right now if they are convicted of DUII.
Okay, so if they fail in
in their diversions are not subject to admission there.
Could I ask a follow-up? Yes. And was it unanimous from the governor's advisory committee on DUII to support this bill?
Yes.
Thanks.
Good questions. I think other questions, committee members? Well, thank both of you for your service on this important committee, and we'll bring up the next two panels. Thank you. The next two people want to testify is Mrs. Meyer and Mr. Johnson. If you please come up. Say ladies first.
Mr. Vice Chair Wisnett, members of the committee, my name is Gail Meyer, here on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. To my left, to your right, is Rankin Johnson IV. He is an attorney in solo practice in Portland. He's been a practitioner in solo practice for 3 years, practicing all stages of the criminal trial proceedings, from trial all the way to federal habeas corpus. Prior to that, he served as an appellate lawyer for OPDS for 5 to 6 years. He's a graduate from the University of Cincinnati Law School, and he's here to discuss this bill from the perspective of the DWI practitioner.
Okay, Mrs. Meyer, you are testifying in opposition to the bill.
We are, yes.
Thank you. So for the committee members, go ahead, thank you, Ms. Johnson. Identify yourself.
Yes, Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee. My name is Rankin Johnson. I am an attorney in Portland, and I am here with OCDLA to testify in opposition to the bill. By prohibiting somebody who has been duly conviction-free for 10 years from reentering diversion, the bill would prevent or reduce the likelihood of treatment and make it more difficult for people who have basically been law-abiding members of society from using the advantages of the diversion program. The ultimate result would be both that fewer of those people would ultimately go through the treatment that they need, and the costs would be substantially higher. Because somebody who goes without a conviction for 10 years is already not likely to be a career criminal, this is somebody who has made significant progress in dealing with whatever addiction issues led to the original arrest. That is the kind of person for whom diversion and other treatment is most likely to be successful. That's not somebody who has an ongoing or lifelong problem. There are always going to be a few exceptions of people who have had many entries into diversion, but in my experience, that is very rare. I've handled, I try to think of what the number is. I've probably had 100 Dewey cases on appeal, and it is common enough for somebody to have one conviction and then go for 10 years or 20 years and then have a diversion, or have a diversion and go for 10 or 20 years and have another one. It is rare that such a person has another criminal record, and it's rare to see a string. In fact, I don't think I've ever seen a string of 3 or 4 diversions. I've never seen that in my career, although I'm sure that such people are out there. In addition, because of the way that Dewey prosecutions tend to work, taking that small class, the people who have had a diversion and then gone 10 years and they have a new charge, preventing them from entering diversion will end up increasing the total cost for those cases significantly. Driving under the influence cases routinely go to trial. They go to trial at a much higher rate than other kinds of criminal prosecutions. That is true partly because there is a statutory mandatory minimum sentence, and because there are routinely complex fact issues, which are not true for other crimes of roughly the same severity, and people who are charged with driving under the influence often can afford their own counsel, and they can afford to litigate the case extensively. As a result, for somebody who cannot enter diversion, it's more likely the case will go to trial, and that involves substantially increased costs. It's also more likely the case will go to appeal, because appeals are more likely to follow trials. That results in increased costs, and it's more likely the person will ultimately be acquitted and will not go through with the treatment program that diversion requires. The last time I represented somebody in the trial court, he was charged with, it was his first charge for driving under the influence, but he had a commercial driver's license, so he wasn't eligible. And so it ended up being a trial case. He wasn't interested in entering a guilty plea if he couldn't avoid the conviction. And he was ultimately acquitted as a result of some technical errors made by the state. everybody would have been better off if he could have entered diversion and done the treatment rather than what actually happened, which was that the state put some effort and some money into prosecuting him and failed. That's not an advantage to anybody, except I suppose to him, and I'm not sure whether he would think that he would be better off having gone through treatment. And so, by taking this small class of people and preventing them from going through with the treatment that diversion provides, the costs are going to go up. I'm not sure how even to calculate whether recidivism would go down, but I'm not sure that it would in light of the increased number of people who would be acquitted and would have no treatment at all. And because this is a small class and it's not likely to be a class of career criminals, it seems like a situation where providing them with some lenience is appropriate. And so for those reasons, this is a poor way to address the issues that it sounds like it's intended to address. Attaching a lifetime cap or some other reduction for genuine hardcore recidivists might make more sense, but this bill is just not a good way to do that. For those reasons, I oppose the bill.
Thank you very much. Representative Shields, you have a question?
Yeah, thank you. So in the case of somebody who's gone through diversion and then they are picked up a second time, generally do the courts, prosecutors, are they able to see the person's previous arrest record generally, even though they might not have had a conviction there? Is there some other kind of warning flag, even though they may have had the record expunged through diversion?
Mr. Vice Chair, Representative Shields, yes, they always know. I mean, I've handled a significant number of those, and everybody knows that there's a diversion. There's no surprise. So at the time of the sentencing for the first conviction, the first diversion is known.
So my understanding then is that this would then play into the plea negotiation process. I mean,
yes, it's certainly correct that the court would consider that as a result. It's something that the parties would consider in deciding what kind of a plea was appropriate.
Other questions, committee members? Representative Dawson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Jones, I have two questions for you. Actually, the first question deals with, have you ever developed maybe what the cost savings would be for having the 10-year diversion? I mean, just keeping it going like that. Because Mr. Chair, you mentioned that you most definitely thought there would be some savings. Just curious what that is.
Sure. Mr. Vice Chair, Representative Olson, I have not. And I don't. I see cases from the perspective of looking at individual ones. But my point is that the litigation cost for taking a case to trial is vastly higher than the cost for a case that goes through diversion or through plea. And driving under the influence cases plea at a lower rate than other kinds of cases. And so taking away diversion is going to result in more trials. And those trials are expensive and they result in appeals, which are also expensive. But I have no idea what the ultimate numbers would be.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
What would be the average cost, do you think, for litigation, as you're describing it?
Mr. Vice Chair, Representative Olson, let's see, the average cost, probably days worth of time for a prosecutor, 2 days worth for, a day or 2 days worth for a police officer, a day's worth for a defense attorney, possibly two, defense investigator. So that's, you know, so then we've got salaries of five or six people, a day of judicial time, six jury members. I mean, some of that it's hard even to put a figure on, but mm-hmm. That's the kind of time that we're talking about using up, as opposed to one-tenth that for diversion. And then the treatment costs, which are generally borne by the defendant, they're not.
We're talking several thousand dollars, those.
Yes,
ballpark.
Easily.
Representative Olson, I think those are great, important questions. We're going to have to be looking at costs of everything, but we'll get a physical on this. The one thing is we're going to get a physical on implementing this policy. We may need a physical on keeping it like it is. What's the cost of that versus, I don't know if we can do that.
We can look into it.
Can we?
Okay. Okay, just one more, if I might, how long is. This is just a suggestion, or actually a suggestion from you. I'm just curious, what would you suggest, I mean, for the individual who is able to slide through the 10-year period after the first diversion, having never been stopped, is constantly having a problem with drinking, and then all of a sudden is able to get to the 11th year from this first arrest, and the potential for him killing somebody or, you know, injuring somebody seriously during that time period existed. Do you have any suggestion what we should do with that individual?
Well, Mr. Vice Chair, Representative Olson, I think that for that person, it's a hard question. If you're talking about a hardcore repeated offender, that, you know, it's, that looks like a very difficult problem. Part of my answer is that there just aren't all that many people like that. The people who go through diversion, that tends to reduce the repeat offenses. I don't see all that many people who do diversion and they get a new charge shortly thereafter. For somebody who does a diversion, they do treatment, they go for 10 years without another charge, that sounds like somebody who is making progress. And I recognize that that having more offenses is not a good thing, but also, you know, I represent people who are who have widely varying degrees of criminal backgrounds, and somebody who commits a crime every 10 years, that's unusual, and it's not a particularly serious background. That sounds like, because that is such a rare scenario, I'm not sure that it requires a special, that it requires a special rule. If there is one, then saying that there's a lifetime cap of say three diversions seems like it's going to capture the majority of such people, and it's going to avoid somebody who is basically a law-abiding person and who every 10 years or every 20 years gets in this particular kind of trouble. And as I say, I've heard a lot of people who have a history like that. They have no criminal history of any kind except for occasional driving under the influence charges, law-abiding citizen, raising a family with lots of responsibilities, and that is not somebody we want to impose the significant consequences of criminal of a driving under the influence conviction on.
Okay. Representative Cameron and yep. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe you don't have the answer to this, but how many arrests are we talking about that are outside the post-tenure period on an annual basis?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, I don't know. I think it's a pretty low number, though. I have not seen a significant number of people who went for 10 years and then were arrested again.
A follow-up, if I may. So this bill that we're looking at here, if it were to pass, would apply to a very limited number of people. And when you say limited, about how many? Do we know?
Mr. Vice Chair and Representative Cameron, I don't know, but it might be hundreds a year. But really, I'm just guessing based on my
Thank
sort
you.
Of limited scope.
Thank you. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question actually for the chair, for somebody more wizened and wise than I. Does this go to Ways and Means after us? And second related question, are we planning on working this bill today?
We'll not work the bill today, and it'll depend upon the fiscal. We get when the revenue looks and sees, you know, is there a cost and how much that costs? Is there a threshold that you have to exceed?
Great.
Before it goes to Ways and Means.
Thank you, Mr. Follow-up question.
Please.
So my question, more of a comment, is something we might consider in the interim if there is time, is I think we have legitimate interests that the governor's committee came up with, that for me, just a flat no vote on this proposal doesn't seem very wise, right? But it does seem that, but I don't know that a yes vote on this proposal seems particularly wise either. And I could imagine at least discussion around three things. Before, let me say this, I think we need to get lawyers, and myself included, who get better at math. Because if we're trying to get maximum safety value, right, from our limited dollar, we need to be able to make those judgments better. And right now, it seems that we make judgments based on who are we most mad at and when are we the most mad, rather than how are we going to keep people most safe. And I want us to get better and better at keeping people safe. But here are three things I could imagine us considering. And if you guys end up working out, that's great. If you don't, I can understand that too. First, it's not just the recidivist point is a really valid point, right? To me, if somebody gets three or four, they should never get diversion again. I don't care if they, if you get three or four in a year, you know, three strikes, you're out and getting diversion. That'd be one thing to consider. Second thing to consider, on the other hand, if this young man, and let's hope that never happens, but if this young man 15 years from now, something bad happens, right, and he goes through it, based on his testimony today, I'm not sure he doesn't deserve another chance. So, you know, is there a way to make it, maybe if it's not 10 years, maybe it's 15 or 20. And third, maybe there's a lifetime cap of two diversions. And my own guess is, if you only did one of those things, you might not get the votes to defeat the current proposal. But if you did all three, you might have a chance in heck. I'm done.
Thank you. Thank you. Mr. Representative Smith and committee members, I'm advised that the Speaker's office does not anticipate a physical on this, but there will be a period for work session. Okay, good.
Is that to the council? Is the assumption there because it would be outside of two or three biennia before we'd actually see a cost?
Representative Shields, they haven't given me their indicators. What's happened right now is the Speaker's office has looked at these and does not anticipate that there's going to be a high fiscal, or else they would have already done an early referral, subsequent referral to Ways and Means. I have not heard from Mr. Walker, who is our LC designated kind of fiscal person.
Excuse me.
Go ahead.
Chair Barker, you're now in the room. Chair Barker, if I could make one more comment.
Sure.
I would just like, if there is to be no fiscal, I'd like to make this comment. Hopefully I'm not beating a dead horse here. It is without doubt the DWI trials go to trial with far greater frequency than any other criminal charge. We criminal defense lawyers know the only real trial lawyers are the DWI lawyers. They're in trial every other week. We go to trial sometimes once every 3 to 4 months at best. So Mr. Johnson made the point that if diversion were no longer an option, you would see a greater number of these cases actually going to trial because they are so triable. The facts are such that they are frequently in dispute. It's the one crime that, quote, many members of the jury have committed themselves in some respects, and there's a high rate of acquittal. And so on the very, very, very first diversion, you almost never see the very first DWI arrest go to trial because almost everyone takes the diversion option because it is so risk-free. If you were to remove that diversion option, that's when you see your spike in your trial rate. So by setting up a disqualification from a second diversion, I believe it's fair to say you would see a spike in those trials.
Representative Siegler.
I just want to be clear on one thing, though. I mean, first of all, this bill doesn't take away diversion, period. It takes away diversion for, and this is my question to you, Mr. Rankin, I want to be real clear. You've indicated it's a very small class of people that we're actually talking about here. Correct?
Yes, okay. That is correct.
And I just want to make sure that we're clear on that.
Sure.
We're all in agreement that we're not talking about a large class of folks here.
Sure, Mr. Chair, Representative Steigler. I think that's accurate, but also in considering the best way to spend limited dollars, we're still talking about an increase from those people and also a higher chance that that small class will go to trial and be acquitted and get no treatment at all. And so I think it may be a small decision, but even so.
Mr. Rankin, just one more question here, and neither one of you can answer this. Neither of you would disagree that the original intent of the diversion program was to give folks a second chance at folks in the DUI who had been arrested for DUI, correct? I mean, that's the original intent, to give somebody a second chance.
Chair Barker, Representative Steigler, a second chance meaning not a second chance to reoffend, obviously. No, but I mean the point being that we want to get them into.
That's right. Get them right.
Get them into treatment.
There's nothing entering that if you go 10 years down. I mean that conversation, I'm assuming, doesn't enter into your when you're counseling a client. It doesn't enter into the conversation that, and you're going to be off the hook for 10 years as long as you don't reoffend for 10 years, you get another bite at the apple 10 years from now. I mean, I'm assuming that it's not sold to them on that. It's, look, you guys, you have an issue here, you have a problem, here's an opportunity to take care of it. Isn't that more or less along the lines of how you discuss the issue with them?
Mr. Chair, Representative Steigler, I consistently encourage my clients not to commit any crimes at all.
No.
Now, given that,
I'm talking about a client who's come into you that has been arrested for a DUI.
But this issue comes up when diversion is available right now, and then my advice would probably be take diversion, and it would surely be don't do it again. Or if it's 10 years since the last diversion, and then, you know,
I understand that, Mr. Johnson, you're not getting the point of my question. When you initially counsel a client who's been arrested on a DUI and who is eligible for a diversion, your conversation does not hover around, you've got this shot now, and by the way, if you stay clean, 10 years down the road, you'd be eligible again. That's not, I mean, the focus is on the here and now. You get a second bite at the apple, you get a second chance.
Mr. Chair, Representative Spiegler, actually, that does come up. And the time it comes up is if there is if there's either a good trial case or there's a good motion to suppress case, in which case, one thing for my client to consider is we might be able to beat the charge now, and then diversion remains as a viable option. And that happens when I think it's something that we might just win at trial.
That's not the question I asked.
I beg your pardon. I misunderstood.
Okay. My point was, you don't discuss whether that 10 years down the road you're going to have another bite at the apple if you screw up.
That's correct.
That's my point. Okay.
Mr. Representative Smith.
So I'm now, and Representative Wisnett gave the answer, and I think it was as you were reentering the room, that we weren't planning working this today. But
that's correct.
Okay, if that's still the answer, then we handle this afterwards. Thanks.
Just one other thing, and again, I apologize for having to step out for a minute. When you were talking about if the person was acquitted, they don't get any treatment, I would assume if the state can't prove it, maybe they don't need any treatment as well. I mean, if I can't get somebody convicted, maybe they weren't a drunk driver.
Mr. Chair, of my clients who ultimately were acquitted, I mean, I don't really know how many of them were actually factually innocent, but probably a minority. I mean, usually it's because there was a good motion to suppress issue, or because the state made a mistake and didn't bring witnesses in, or because there was reasonable doubt, even though they were probably guilty, but not guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. I suggest that as a class, that's a group of people who would benefit from treatment, although I'm sure a few of them are genuinely, factually, just not guilty of anything.
Thank you. Further questions? Thank you very much. Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Garrett.
Quick question.
He did tell me.
Thank you. I'm sorry this was covered earlier, and I didn't catch it, but if someone meets the statutory criteria for diversion currently, is diversion available as of right to them, or is it discretionary?
Mr. Chair, Representative Garrett, it is available as of right. There's no discretion to deny diversion, assuming they meet the criteria.
I was just going to suggest that if there's going to be some discussion about between the various groups here, right now the bill would remove from eligibility for diversion a person who has a prior diversion. Maybe one way to approach it is to allow some element of discretion. Not to say they are statutorily ineligible, but that the DA would have some discretion to make a determination. Maybe getting Representative Smith's question about somebody who does this in 20 years, we'd want, you know, I think, to have some flexibility in the system to account for that.
Sure.
So I'll just put that out there for consideration.
Mr. Chair, Representative Garrett, if I could mention very briefly, diversion often refers to a program that's administered by the DA's office. It's essentially a plea bargain. That is not the way that Dewey diversion works, which is administered by the court. Mm-hmm. And from your comments, you mentioned making it discretionary with the district attorney's office. My view would be that making it discretionary with the court would be a better approach to that problem. And that would be more consistent with the way that Dewey diversion in particular is currently administered. And that does seem like one possible approach.
Did we enter this? We didn't acknowledge this letter
yes.
yet? Yes. We did, okay. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2331.
We're there.
And open a public hearing on House Bill 2332.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2332 addresses spousal privilege and provides that if either spouse voluntarily discloses a confidential communication, the other spouse could not claim spousal privilege. There's already an amendment that's going to be in front of you. It's not down at LC yet, but it's revised language. You'll see it. We do not have a fiscal on this, so even though you have an amendment, we are not ready to work this. And just for clarification, you will be hearing another bill on this statute, which is 40.255. You'll be hearing another bill on this. It's a separate issue dealing with privilege, so that's up next.
Okay, if we could have the first panel up. Gail Meyer, Denny Mason, Susan Reese, and Andrea Meyer, please. You can all come up. The four of you come up. And people who are opposed to it. Yeah. And we, again, we're not going to work it today, and there is an amendment, so. You can go in any order you wish. Just please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Chair Barker and members of the committee. My name is Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Attorneys. I have here to my left, your right, firstly, Denny Mason. He is the deputy lobbyist for the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers. He is a third-year law student at Willamette University. He previously to this experience with OCDLA, he was an extern with the Court of Appeals last semester and working with Judges Landau, Ortega, and Schumann, and attended college where in New Mexico, where he worked for the Coalition Against the Death Penalty. I've asked Mr. Mason if he would testify. He did some legal research on the longstanding roots of the husband-wife privilege, its policy reasons, and why it's prevailed for several centuries now. And further to my left is Susan Reese. She is one of Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association's most experienced attorneys. She has been a solo practitioner in Portland, and now she's got a satellite office in Newport. For the past 35 years, she practices in Oregon and Washington. She has a statewide practice in Oregon, exclusively doing criminal defense in child and sex abuse defense allegations. Previous to that, she was, for 33 years, she also did family law. So Ms. Reese has a lot of experience with litigation with charges that involve husband and wife testimonial issues. She's a graduate of Harvard Law School in 1972. I have no immediate comments. I would like to suggest that we begin with Mr. Mason.
Okay? Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I just did some preliminary sort of background research on this, and I just have a couple quick comments. Obviously, the policy reasons for the spousal privilege, it's really intended to protect and facilitate marital intimacy. And just as a one thing to highlight about that, it's one of the oldest privileges. Shortly, it's the second oldest privilege, actually, in our legal system, right after the attorney-client privilege. It's been recognized since the 17th century, and it is currently recognized in some form in every jurisdiction in the U.S., including the federal government. I would just note that it's interesting that the attorney-client came first, then the spousal privilege, and I think it's interesting to see that, you know, you should be able to tell your spouse more than you can tell your attorney without worrying that they're going to end up testifying about it against you. And that's pretty much about the history that I have. Okay. Thank you.
I'll just ask a question. You said it's in some form in every state. Does any state have something similar to this?
Most states, in fact, have.
I mean, a provision that's on the bill.
Have provisions very similar to ours now. Actually, there are potentially two states that have something similar to what the bill is proposing.
That's right.
But currently, all of the states are more similar to what we have now. In fact, there are also two states that are expanding beyond what we have now and actually recognizing civil unions as well as marriages for these privileges.
Actually, Chair Barker, I wonder if it might be helpful if I just perhaps outline in very brief form what the proposed bill does, House Bill 2332. And it's difficult perhaps for me to know exactly the amendments that are forthcoming, but this is as I understand it. There will be a redefinition of what it means to be a confidential communication between a spouse. Right now, the definition is a confidential communication, communication by a spouse to another spouse, not intended to be disclosed to any other person. I understand that there will be an amendment to that that would say not intended by the speaker to be disclosed to any other person. By so amending the definition of a confidential communication, it would affect civil litigation as well as criminal litigation, and I've pointed that out to the proponents of the amendment. I think their intent was to have this bill only apply to criminal actions, but if you redefine confidential communications, you're affecting civil litigation as well.
Go ahead.
Another aspect of House Bill 2332 2332 is that in a criminal action only, it would remove the entitlement of the defendant spouse to prevent a testifying spouse from testifying. Right now in the marital privilege, both parties are entitled to keep the confidence of the other. One is entitled to elect not to testify, and one can also prevent the other from testifying. And they hope in a criminal case to remove that privilege such that a testifying spouse, no, the defendant's spouse cannot prevent a testifying spouse from testifying in a criminal action. Then they do one other thing. If there is a confidential communication between husband and wife, brushing their teeth in the bathroom, someone says something, and then a month later, and at the time it's communicated, it's intended to remain confidential. But a month later, at a dinner party, someone blurts out some aspect of that communication that had occurred a month earlier. The bill then would remove the privilege as to that communication and would suggest that it never existed. And so those are the effects of the bill. I just thought perhaps it might be necessary to review those before Ms. Reese gave her talk.
Ms. Sill?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'd just like to point out that the amendment that you have in front of you is intended to address the civil aspects brought up by Ms. Meyer, that they would, the civil privilege would not be affected under the proposed amendment in front of you. It's all in the criminal realm, and I believe Ms. Skinner will probably address that as well, but I wanted you to have that awareness right away as you're listening to the testimony. But that's already been addressed in the amendment.
Okay. Chair Barker, Chair Barker, members of the committee, my comment, though, is I understand that the proponents of the bill are intending to only affect criminal actions. My point is that by changing some of the definition of what it means to be a confidential communication, by changing that definition, it could have impact in civil litigations as well.
Okay, thank you.
Chairman Barker, members of the committee, thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak to you. My name is Susan Elizabeth Reese, as Gail indicated, and I've been in practice throughout the state for over 35 years, and I have handled a lot of dissolution of marriage cases as well as almost exclusively criminal cases for the last 10 years or so. I'm concerned about the erosion of the marital privilege. It's been, in essence, sacred throughout the common law and in many states. And I'm concerned about the wedge that this proposed statute would put into that privilege. It will encourage more litigation over the question of what is a confidential communication, was it intended to be confidential at the time, was it disclosed intentionally, was it disclosed inadvertently. Spouses are going to be getting attorneys of their own. The testifying spouse will have to get his or her attorney in the course of the criminal case to represent an issue that may involve a privilege, and it's going to prolong the process as well as making it more complicated. Spouses say things that they don't mean when they're angry and upset and have fights, and they may make threats or they may threaten to disclose information that has come out in the bedroom or brushing teeth or under other circumstances. And to have the state come in and say, well, we can order that you testify against your spouse at a later time is really very chilling and very detrimental to intact marriages as well as marriages that are rocky. I have seen in my practice what happens when a family is torn apart because there is no privilege. There's no privilege between a parent and a child. And when children over 15 are subject to Measure 11 offenses and they may do something wrong and come home and tell their parents, they are horrified and their parents are horrified to discover that the parents then become witnesses against them. Even if they're not witnesses, if the child says something that the prosecutor might choose to use, the support system of the youngster in the criminal justice system is gone if the parent is then on the state's witness list and has to stay outside the courtroom for the duration of the trial. So those kinds of things happen when there's no privilege, and if the privilege between spouses is eroded, it's going to place a chilling effect on the marital relationship and on the freedom of communication that necessarily needs to occur there. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Krieger.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to have to leave. I got another appointment coming up, but strange it might seem, I've got a real problem with some of the concept that's in there and what it could be mean, as you said, where there's a marital problem, things are going on, they haven't separated yet. Where this could go, I think we have to be very, very careful.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Meyer, the other Ms. Meyer.
The other Ms. Meyer. Chair Barker, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, legislative director for the ACLU of Oregon, joining here today in our opposition to this proposal. Section 1, subsection 2, makes a fundamental and significant erosion to the privilege doctrine, and I'm sorry we didn't have the proponents, for my own sake, testifying first to understand what is behind some of the reasons for this, but it absolutely removes the protections that have been part of our law. And as a subset, I have concerns about the changes on lines 25 to 27 in terms of language and definitions. If either spouse voluntarily, I'm not sure what that means. I'm not sure if that might be someone who is facing potential charges themselves if they don't choose to disclose the information, so they voluntarily disclose it. And I don't know what a significant part of a confidential communication would be. And we'll, if something like that were to go through, unfortunately, we would probably spend years in courts just trying to define these new terms as applied. So, beyond the language problems, just a fundamental opposition to this type of change in our law, as Representative Krieger noted, sort of the fundamental nature to it. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Reese. Thank you for your coming down here.
Thank you.
Ms. Skinner.
Thank you, members of the committee, Chair Barker. My name is Gina Skinner. I'm a deputy district attorney in Washington County, and I have been a district attorney for over 11 years. A proposal for House Bill 2332 comes from the Oregon District Attorney Association, and we're asking the committee to consider the following changes. The written testimony that is being passed around right now, I apologize, started out as just some notes for myself, and it got too long, and so I finally decided that I would just disseminate them. So there are a couple of corrections that I want to make as I briefly go through describing the reasoning behind the three changes that we're asking this committee to make to the current statute. As was previously mentioned, there are basically two privileges that exist under current Oregon law, and there are basically two privileges that exist generally in the law. The first section under 1A, little I, that should be prevents a witness spouse, so that's confusing. But basically, the testimonial privilege, which currently exists under Oregon law, states that a witness who is testifying can choose to not testify against their spouse, against other things that are not confidential communication. So this can include observations or other types of testimony. But at any time under the law, that witness spouse can choose to not testify, and this doesn't change that. And that's a longstanding part of the law. The second part is the confidential communications privilege, and that is what we're talking about, where there's a communication that is confidential between two married people, and that under the current Oregon law, either party can prevent either party from ever testifying about a communication that was made in confidence. And that communication privilege exists beyond the marriage. So even once the parties are divorced, 10 years later, that ex-spouse can continue to prevent that witness spouse from ever testifying in a criminal court about that confidential communication. So one of the issues about the definition section of what makes a communication confidential is that it is important for the person that is actually making the statement to have ever actually intended for that statement to be confidential, to understand what that is. The second correction I'd ask you to make, and it's the last one, is where it says small 4 under B. That really should be a C, and that should be a separate section. That should be that those are exceptions to both privileges, not just the second privilege. And that those exceptions exist under law because there's been an evolution of this privilege. And that the three exceptions are that in civil law, if the spouses are adverse parties, then there's no privilege at all. And anybody can be called to testify in the courtroom. Also, in conversations that occurred prior to the marriage, but specifically has been added by statute because of public policy that certain crimes are exempted. So if you are a victim of a crime by your spouse, or your children are a victim of a crime by your spouse, then the privilege, it disintegrates. It doesn't exist, and the state is allowed to call that witness spouse, or the victim in that case, as a witness in the criminal charges. I go through and very briefly talk about the history of the federal rule, and actually there is not, and there has never been, a federal rule of evidence dealing with marital privilege. The court talks about how that they are going to govern by the principles of common law to allow them to continue to evolve over time, because it's not something that's hard and fast, and in fact it has changed. Originally, marital privilege included that neither spouse was allowed to ever testify for or against either spouse under any circumstances ever, criminal or civil. You can even testify for them that they thought they were a great person. The court never allowed that, and so that has evolved and changed. And in 1980, the Supreme Court decided Trammell v. United States. And I cite this quite a bit in my memo because it is they are discussing the testimonial privilege, not the confidential communications privilege. But they do make some important notes talking about this evolution and talking about how the ancient foundations for so sweeping a privilege has long since disappeared. Nowhere in the common law world, indeed in any modern society, is a woman regarded as chattel or demeaned by denial of a separate legal identity and the dignity associated with recognition as a whole human being. Chip by chip, over the years, those archaic notions have been cast aside so that no longer is a female destined solely for the home and the rearing of family, and only the male the marketplace of the world of ideas. And it talks about how, over time, that a person who is a witness should be given the rights and the privileges of a person to be able to make those kind of decisions for themselves. And so under Oregon law, what we're asking is in these three changes. First of all, in subsection 2, to remove the language that prevents the other spouse from disclosing be able to say something that they believe would be any kind of a confidential communication. So if the witness spouse wants to come testify, they should be able to do so. We cannot make them. It has to be a choice. And so we don't want to force people to testify. And as I do cite, there are two states in Rhode Island and Indiana, and I cite the statutes that do currently allow this. And they talk about, in the Indiana case, it talks about how witness spouse had told the police that her defendant husband had admitted killing another woman. The defendant tried to prevent his wife from testifying about the statements, and the court held that it could not require her to testify, but it would allow a willing spouse to testify to those spousal communications. So currently under Oregon law, if we have a situation where a spouse is told by the defendant, a defendant comes home and says, I killed the neighbor. I sexually abused the neighbor's children. I committed some horrific crime, and tells this to the spouse. And whether it was that day or 10 years later after a divorce, that spouse wants to reveal that to the police and wants justice to be found for those victims of those crimes, the state is never able to use those statements or those witness. That spouse will never be allowed to come to court to testify. That defendant will always be able to hold them hostage to the fact that they are or were married at the time that those statements or that confession to that crime was given. And the point here is that victims deserve to have justice under those circumstances. When we have a willing spouse, justice and victims deserve the right to have their voices heard more than the defendant has a right to silence something that is the truth in the matter. The second section is that we're talking about in subsections 3, or down in talking about voluntary disclosing a confidential communication. If a victim or a witness spouse, if they repeat something that was part of what at the time may have been a confidential communication. They are no longer intending for that to be a confidential communication. And Oregon law talks about, and it says in here, that it is the intent of the parties for it to be confidential. And this is just further defining that if you do, in fact, you know, repeat it at a dinner party, post it on a MySpace page, share it with all your friends, you never intend for it to be confidential, that would then remove that privilege from that statement. It would be something that we would be allowed to use in a court of law. And again, the same type of example, we have had cases where witnesses have said something to their spouse, not intending for it to be confidential, but they may have been the only people in the room when it was said. And the reaction of the spouse then turns around and commits some sort of crime. That communication, even though the witness spouse wants to come in and talk about it, they may have told their mother, their sister, their friends, their family, they may have told everybody, and they have put it on their MySpace page, that defendant can always prevent that witness spouse from coming to testify about this communication that they meant to be public, they meant later for it to be shared. And that is currently under Oregon law, very confusing and very vague in the manner in which it has been interpreted by the courts. For a practical matter, this doesn't come up all that often. I don't believe that the litigation costs are going to be large, like we've been discussing. It's not uncommon currently for a victim to obtain an attorney or a witness to obtain an attorney. That does happen from time to time. As long as the rules are clear, then it's less likely that we're going to be litigating these issues. Really what we're doing is we're putting the right back into the witness individual to be able to make an educated choice about whether they want to come to court and testify or not, and that if their actions are such that they disseminate information to the public, then the privilege is lost and that information can be used in a criminal court. And the intention behind this bill is for this only to apply to criminal cases and for it to not affect civil cases. Thank you.
Thank you. If I tell my wife something, she blurts it out when she's drunk, tells Representative Olson's wife, and then can she be forced to testify to that, then it's no longer confidential, or could she still say, no, I'm not going to repeat that?
Chair Barker, that, you know, that would come under the issue about whether or not that the information was voluntarily disclosed, and it also has to be a significant part of that communication. So if there was just a comment, then I would say no. It specifically says a significant part to try to clarify that the intent is for that whole communication or the gist of that entire communication to be shared with other people. Because even if you do share it only with Mr. Olson's wife, Representative Olson's wife, she may share it then with 20 other people, and so it's sort of at that point it's out of the bag, and at some point it would be considered to be public information.
Thank you. Further questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Skinner. I have there are two components.
There are two components about this that trouble me. And first, after the amendments, I do feel somewhat better. Although I still find it troubling because, well, at least I'm not on last night when I read the bill and realized that it would essentially undermine the spousal privilege in civil and criminal matters. I sort of freaked out. I've calmed down quite a bit since then. But even still, I find it hard to make a principled distinction, I suppose, as to why the spousal privilege does apply in a civil context and not in a criminal context. I granted there are some important distinctions, and I mean, I could make distinctions and could make arguments, but that does still trouble me. I wanted to say that. And then second, going to your testimony, which I appreciate, you made very good arguments, particularly, for example, when you speak about any one individual case. And privilege is kind of a funny thing, because in any individual case, it's problematic. Because it's literally, I mean, there's relevant communications that are not being allowed to appear into evidence. And that's always troubling. But, of course, from the macro perspective, we're trying to facilitate certain kinds of communications, whether they be between a lawyer and client, between spouses, between a priest and parisher. And it seems that your arguments used here actually, frankly, could apply to any of those privileges. For example, used the one example of a spouse and whereas the husband comes back and tells the wife, I just committed a heinous crime, etc. And then 10 years later, she decided that she wants justice. Similarly, I practice civil litigation myself. I don't have any criminal practice, but let's assume I did. And let's assume Representative Smith came and told me, in seeking legal advice, that he committed some heinous crime.
Or is a spouse.
Oh, yeah. Why doesn't the same argument apply with equal force to why we should abolish the attorney-client communication, or does it?
Chair Barker, Representative Barton, we are not seeking to change any other privileges. One of the things that I, when doing some research on this, that I came upon when you distinguish the marital privilege is that so many of the other privileges, whether they're attorney-client or priest parishioner, you're with that person for such a limited period of time and for such a narrow focus. And usually if you're going to go talk to your attorney, you've paid the money, you have an appointment, you show up, you're there for an hour, you share some very specific information, and you're trying to get some very specific advice, and similar situation with the priest. And that the law finds that in order to be able to get advice, to be able to get accurate legal advice, you have to have a shroud of secrecy over that limited time. However, if you saw that same person, that attorney, or even that priest, at a cocktail party, and you were just talking with them about something, maybe off somewhere where other people were unable to hear it, would you consider that to be a confidential communication? You were maybe just talking about whatever. And that's where, and most people would say no, because that wasn't the intent of the conversation, and it's clear from the objectiveness that it isn't to be confidential. The problem with the marital privilege is it is all-encompassing. Many people are with this person for, 8, 10, 12 hours a day. Where do you draw the line? What's confidential and what's not? And any time that person is a much larger opportunity for that person to be exposed by happenstance to one's criminal behavior that would occur, whether it was in the home or that it was somewhere else, and then they came back and shared it. And just by the fact that you have been or had been married to this person, that you are allowing that person to prevent the other person from testifying. Because if you go to an attorney and you talk to them, that doesn't prevent you from telling your friends what you told to the attorney. That attorney can't tell you that you can't tell other people that. And so that's basically what we're seeing, because if you want it to be confidential, it will remain that way on both sides. And that stays the same way here. This is talking about marriages that are breaking down. These aren't people that want to be in confidence. If they wanted to be in confidence, they would never share this information. If it was never shared, no one would ever know, and it would never get out. You could murder your neighbor and tell your spouse, and if you have a great marriage, it'll probably never come out, and you can live together in perfect harmony, as it contemplates in the marital privilege. However, when that starts to break down and one person wants justice to be found, they should be able to be given the right, just as you seeking advice from an attorney or a priest, you would have that right to be able to tell other people about what your conversation entailed. Does that answer your question?
Thank you.
Thank you. Further questions? Okay, thank you. We have one more. Where's my list? Mr. Pucci, please. Hope I said that right. Thank you.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, I am Steve Pucci. I'm a civil plaintiff's trial lawyer from Portland, and I'm also the chair of the Oregon State Bar Board of Governors Public Affairs Committee. I appreciate counsel's efforts throughout the day to address the issues we had this morning about the application of this bill to the civil law. And I think that by and large our concerns have been addressed, which is why I speak as a neutral on the subject. But I do feel it necessary to point out two things. One is that as a chair of Public Affairs Committee and our committee itself take great pains in attempting to find consensus among the various bar groups, sections, and committees on bills that affect the law, the rule of law, and the statutes of the state. And I don't think that that's been done yet. We would always seek to try to do that going in instead of scrambling things as they are. We're here today. The second point is that, as Representative Barton has pointed out and others, on the issue of privileges themselves, these are fundamental principles in our system of jurisprudence that have been developed over centuries. I appreciate the gentleman from Willamette Law who gave us a bit of the history, but we don't just have attorney-client and marital privileges. We have penitent clergy, we have physician-patient, we have patient-psychotherapist, and they are some serious matters that apply overarchingly across all legal cases. And in terms of how this bill may affect civil law based on the definition of confidential communications, I share the first Ms. Myers' concern about that, though the main civil issues that were barking at us have been addressed, and we do appreciate that. So unless there are any other questions, I'll conclude.
Just one question. You would agree, is it Mr. Pucci?
Pucci.
Okay. That the various privileges over time have derived from a variety of different, I guess we would say, impetuses and sources. Some have come from civil law, common law. Some are purely creatures of statute, or, you know, as sort of life has played out over the last several hundred years. Would you agree with that?
Chair Barker, Representative Steigler, yes, I would certainly have to agree with
and,
that.
And even some of those deriving out of common law come from different points and perspectives as to what exactly is either being protected or coveted, so to speak. Would you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
The first week of law school, you learn that the law is a seamless web and things affect it and it grows.
Right. Thank you.
Hey, thank you. No further questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you
for taking the time to testify. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2332. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2333, and I expect to go no longer than 3:30 today.
House Bill 2333 allows a grand jury to receive an evidence and affidavit authenticating the records of a financial institution. We do not yet have a fiscal on this.
Mr. Berry, please.
Chair Barker, representatives of the committee, I am Brad Berry, Yamhill County District Attorney and Chair of the Oregon District Attorneys Association Legislative Committee. This bill, I hesitate to, but it is really mostly a housekeeping bill. Currently, in conducting grand jury investigations, it is not uncommon that documents are subpoenaed to the grand jury for the purpose of their review or in the investigative function as an aid to law enforcement in their investigations. Currently, as you can see from looking at the remainder of the statute, that has not changed. Such things as medical records and the like can be forwarded to the grand jury under a seal that shows it's a certified copy, an affidavit that shows it's a certified and true copy of the records that exist. However, we don't have such an exception currently for financial records. Because of that, then, for example, if you have a grand jury investigation in Medford of a bank that has its home office in Portland, you'll have somebody from Portland have to drive down to grand jury. They go in, they get placed under oath, they say, is this a copy of the record? Yes, it is. Here it is, and that's it. It is very perfunctory. What this allows them to do is the same process as we do with other records, merely by affidavit. The custodian of the record says it's a true and accurate copy of the records, and it's sent to us by mail typically, and is then submitted to the grand jury and reviewed at that point. So again, I'm unaware of any opposition to this. I've had the opportunity to talk with bankers about it who don't see a problem with it, and candidly look forward not having to spend the time and money to send folks to grand jury for really is something that is unnecessary.
Thank you. Any questions? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Close the public hearing on House Bill 2333. Representative Smith, will you be able to hang around for a few more minutes, or you need to go?
If you need me, I can tell my other chair to...
We need six people.
Yeah. So. Great, I'll stick around.
Okay, thank you. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2338. Ms. Sybil.
House Bill 2338 again addresses a different privilege issue under ORS 40.255, and rather than going through and explaining it into detail, I think if it's okay with you, Mr. Chair, we'll have the witness come forward on it. Again, we do not have a fiscal on this, so we're unable to work it today.
Thank you. Ms. Skinner.
Thank you, Your Honor. Again, my name is Gina Skinner. I am representing the Oregon District Attorney Association. I'm a Deputy District Attorney in Washington County. I'm speaking in favor of House Bill 2338, and this is the same statute as that I was testifying regarding previously. However, we're seeking to add a separate section to this bill. Currently, under the laws I had mentioned before, there are a number of exceptions that are that take out something from being a privilege. So currently, as I mentioned before, it's a civil action and the parties are adverse parties, that would be exempted. And if there was a criminal action where the witness spouse was the victim of a crime or the children of either party was a victim of a crime, then that would be exempted from the privilege. What this is seeking to do is just adding to the definition of that section and saying that if there was a minor child that the defendant spouse had a legal duty to protect, that would take it out of the exemption. And currently, the definition for what a legal duty is under the criminal mistreatment statute, and it specifically states that a legal duty includes but is not limited to a duty created by a familial relationship, court order, contractual agreement, or statutory or case law. And so this is specifically designed to address cases where we have foster children, or what we had a case very recently in Washington County with a daycare, where the defendant daycare provider had significantly injured one of the children under their contractual care. They were burned in the daycare center. And then the witness spouse to the daycare provider defendant had come home after the fact, and there was significant period of time that passed and conversations that most likely occurred that delayed significantly the treatment and care for that child, and the state was unable to ever produce that witness spouse as a witness in the criminal case against the defendant because they were able to claim marital privilege. If it had been their own child that had the same situation that had occurred, that would not have been a privilege and by statute would have been exempted and the state would have been allowed to call that person as a witness. And so we feel that any time that an adult falls into the role of in parentis, where they have a legal responsibility for a child, that they should have the same obligations and should not be able to hide under the marital privilege under these circumstances.
Questions?
I have one, Mr. Chair.
Please. Representative Wisnett.
I don't understand Section 2 about when it goes into effect. Do I read Paragraph 1 correctly, that it's going to be retroactive?
Chair Barker, Representative Wisnett, I'm looking at that section. I believe that it is applying to conversations. The way this is written, it appears to apply to conversations that occurred prior to the effective date of the act, however, would not apply to any, would only apply to crimes that were filed after the act. Is that correct?
That's my understanding.
Okay. So that if a crime had occurred after the act went into effect, referencing a conversation that may have happened prior to the implementation of the act, and that would be what this would cover.
Mr. Chair, and this could be a question either for staff or frankly for anyone. First of all, Representative Wisnett, good eye. I missed it. And I'm wondering if that presents some constitutional issues or ex post facto problems.
There's not an ex... Chair Barker and Representative Barton, there would be an ex post facto issue when you're just dealing with a issue of dealing with the evidence code and how to apply the rules of evidence. It's not increasing a criminal penalty or creating a new crime against the person. The crime itself still exists. It's just how the evidence would be allowed into court.
Okay, thank you.
And Chair Barker, Representative Wisnett, if that's an issue, that most likely something we can fix. That wasn't necessarily part of what we drafted as far as the timeline. So,
thank you. Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I guess my concern was, are we opening up, you know, remember we had the Blake Leak issue where you had to go back, and we, you know, is that the same sort of issue that...
This would be for only things that are filed after 45 days.
But yeah. You still could go back and get evidence from prior to that would come in, right?
If you set it prior to that, yes, but only if the crime was then filed after this goes into effect.
Yeah, they can't go back to cases that are already out there.
Thank you.
Ms. Meyer, Ms. Reese, and Mr. Mason again, please. And again, we're not going to work the case today. We are kind of up against the timeline, but I want you to say everything you need to say. Okay, sure. Thank you.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, my name is Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. With respect to House Bill 2338, again, what I see the proponents doing is splicing apart the privilege as it relates from civil cases to criminal cases. To some extent existing, there already is a splicing of that privilege in some narrow instances, but this would do it yet again still further. If we were to take the example posed by Ms. Skinner when she described the reach of what they're trying to accomplish here in forcing a spouse to testify against another spouse with respect to conduct occurring in the home of a daycare provider, one would think that exception to the privilege rule then should logically also apply to a civil case, because a parent of that child who is injured may want to sue the daycare provider. And so the question is posed, why then only have this amendment apply to a criminal case and not a civil case? And I would submit to the committee it really is strategic. It's to dilute the voice in opposition to the bill. I note that Mr. Pucci is now gone on behalf of who is a member of the Trial Lawyers Association and the Oregon State Bar. But really, logically, if you were to look at the privilege and the purpose of the privilege, which is to promote marital intimacy, you would think under the example proffered by the proponents here that it would, the justification for an exception to that privilege would apply with equal merit to both a civil action and a criminal one. With respect to Vice Chair Wisnant's question with respect to retroactivity, it does state that, as written anyway, it would pick up confidential communications that existed prior to the effective date of the bill, but it would only apply to actions and proceedings filed forward. But a pre-existent confidential communication that was privileged when made would now be picked up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Questions?
Sorry,
go ahead.
Did you
have anything?
Well, I would just add that...
Yeah, just play a record.
Denny Mason, Chair Barker, members of the committee. I would just add that that was also the case with House Bill 2332. If you want to look back at Section 2, that is also similarly retroactive.
I saw that.
Ms. Reese?
Thank you, Representative Barker, Chairman, members of the committee, Susan Elizabeth Reese from Portland and Newport, testifying on behalf of OCDLA and urging opposition to this bill. Again, it really puts a wedge between spouses, and I'm concerned that a number of things with this exception. Why just offenses against minor children? Why not homicides? Why not vehicular manslaughter? Why not all kinds of other crimes? If there is a specific concern about foster parents, maybe there should be something in the foster parent codes or the civil codes that address those things, but not the spousal privilege, because in fact the definition of a child to whom there is a legal duty states, as Ms. Skinner reported, that the legal duty includes but is not limited to a duty created by family relationships, court order, and so forth. So there's going to be limitation. There's going to be litigation on what that legal duty is. What's included in the but not limited to? Is it a lifeguard? Is it a babysitter? Is it a temporary Sunday school teacher in the course of encountering a minor child, mentions to the spouse, gosh, you know, that youngster was really coming on to me, I'm really feeling uncomfortable about it, and then 3 weeks later there's some kind of a charge involving that minor child, and the spouse is then called to testify against the person who's made the statement. And are these statements reliable, and what are the spouses going to do? I mean, I've discussed this with a number of professionals who say to me, well, gosh, you know, if I were called to testify against my spouse, I would be tempted to lie and say there were no communications whatsoever. And so it really may foster disrespect for law to the extent that people are going to say, gosh, I'm looking at my relationship with my spouse versus a legal command. Is it going to be used by district attorneys just as fishing expeditions, calling in a spouse to the grand jury and saying, what did your spouse say to you? What does the defendant's spouse say about his or her relationship with his minor child to try to get evidence? So I think there's really a lot of concern about how it's going to be used, about the definitions, the extent to which it could be applied in all kinds of areas in which adults and children are involved, and if in fact there's some concern about one area of crime, why not other areas of crime? I think it just starts a ball rolling, and we can expect more of these later on if this privilege is allowed to be jeopardized this way, and so I would urge you to vote against this. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Oh, yes, Chair, please, go ahead.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, if I could just add with respect to the incentives that this bill puts on spouses, and going back to the reason for the initial spousal privilege, the reason for the privilege was that you didn't want to put the spouse, or one of the reasons, I don't want to say that there's only one, but one of the reasons is that you don't want to put the spouse in the position of being forced to decide, do I want to, A, send my wife to jail, B, go to jail myself for being in contempt of court, or C, lie in court. And that is the problem, and that's one of the policy foundations of the spousal privilege. So we don't want to put people in that position.
Okay, thank you very much. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2338 and open the public hearing on House Bill 2356.
I just wanted to say, as people might trickle out, how much I appreciate the really just high quality of witnesses and testimony we've had all day today.
And we appreciate them taking the time to come in.
One of the most interesting afternoons I've had in a while. Sad to say.
Yeah.
Ms. Civil, 2356, please.
With respect to House Bill 2356, I'd like you to disregard some of the language in your SMS. I did a redraft and simply did not bring it in today. The language addressing setting aside convictions and changing that to expungements is not going to be part of the ultimate draft. It's going to be submitted. There are amendments on the way. Rather, I think the focus here today and with the testimony is going to be the clarification and adding that certain crimes are not eligible to be set aside. So I apologize for that confusion. And again, no fiscals.
Mr. Chair, may I ask a question of staff?
Yes.
One technical question at the outset. Can you explain to me the difference, if any? This changes, for example, the term setting aside to expunge. Are those fungible terms, or is there a legal difference?
There's two different processes, and I will apologize. In my prior field, I should say, I often use the term expungements. We bandy it about as you know to mean set aside, and it really they're different things.
Very different.
Yeah. So,
Mr. Berry,
I'd love to learn more about that distinction.
Bradbury, Yamhill County District Attorney and Chair of the Oregon District Attorneys Association Legislative Committee. Thank you for hearing House Bill 2356. If only briefly, I've advised the Chair of this. Chair Barker and members of the committee. This particular issue that we're seeking to deal with here is one of looking at changes to the process that allows offenders to set aside records of previous convictions and arrest. And counsel is right. That we really didn't pick up till later when we started looking at this and getting more in the session that the bill had used the term expunge. And as you might recall, when I testified on behalf of Representative Olson's bill, I tried to make that distinction that they are very different legal, not necessarily processes, but they are different legal distinctions in the end result. And the adult processes are motions to set aside. The only place expungements are used is in the juvenile system. So again, I think everybody's in agreement that the motions to set aside is what we're looking at here. As I also mentioned when I testified on behalf of Representative Olson's bill, we meaning the District Attorney's Association, are looking for a broader discussion about what should and should not be included in the statute that allows for setting aside previous convictions. The statute has been somewhat of a hodgepodge. It's been amended over and over, added to, taken out of, and now really causes problems from a real world. For example, one just example would be you could technically set aside a prior conviction of a domestic assault conviction, whereas since that would have been authorized now, a prior conviction for domestic assault on the same victim would be a felony. So we create a statute that makes a prior conviction a predicate, and then we now go forward and say, but geez, you can put it aside and we can't ever use it again. And it has, they are at least competing interests, if not total contradictions. Our hope is to establish, and in fact we already have a meeting set up between members of the ODAA and OCDLA for next week to discuss this broader thing. We see certain items that are precluded from being subject to being set aside that could be added, and there are others that we think should not be allowed, and that's a discussion I think that needs to happen. I appreciate Chair Barker, you calling this. It leaves us a placeholder to further work with this issue, and this bill clearly needs more work. It was intended up front just to open the discussion, and that's why it's here.
Okay, thank you very much. Any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would appreciate if counsel, especially for us non-legals, could really maybe do a talking point or a one-pager on this issue. Because the one concern I have, too, is what's the benefit? Why are we doing this? What's the benefit to society by doing this? And Mr. Berry's example about, if you set aside and the person does the same thing and it was based, and the crime or the punishment would be much more severe, we'd known about the first one that's been set aside. That doesn't seem to be serving society. I don't know.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wisnett, if it would fit that, then I would be happy to do a write-up for the next time when this bill comes up again so that it more fleshes out more fully the ramifications.
Thank you.
Chair Barker, if I may, and Representative Wisnett, members of the committee, our hope would be to come back and bullet point the changes it makes. I would expect that we may actually want to look at kind of a wholesale rewrite as the statute has gone through so many changes. It really is confusing what it does and does not cover. And candidly, from our perspective, we'll come back and say these are what we think ought to be excluded from the right to set aside, and these are what we think you ought to add that currently you can't set aside. For example, traffic crime arrests that didn't result in convictions ought to be in there, and I know that there are others. So we will point those out for you, and I'm confident that there will be areas where we will not come to agreement with the defense bar, and they're going to argue, I'm certain, reasons why this should be included or excluded.
Just, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One final comment for the committee members, because this, on education last year, and we got into the issue about some teachers with problems and sexual things, that we got into this because it goes across the spectrum as far as if a teacher's had a problem and then she thinks it's a sponge and she comes in and fills out the form to teach, she's lied if she says it's been set aside, because it's not, you don't set it aside, is what it was understood. So it's a real, across the spectrum of state laws, it's a problem and what it means and what it doesn't mean and how we're implementing that. So I would.
It's the opposite.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Ms. Meyer.
Yeah.
You wanted. Did you?
Did I?
And surprisingly enough, you're opposed to it.
I'm sorry.
That's okay. I mean, we're not having a hearing today. I mean, we're not going to work today, so
if if I did that, I would surprise.
Okay.
We wouldn't be talking.
Okay,
yeah.
Thank you. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2356. We have a bill to an LC to submit a draft. I accept a motion to adopt LC 2725. And once again, by voting for this doesn't mean approval or support of it.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I move the committee adopt LC 2725.
Representative Barton moves we adopt LC 2725. Any discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Excuse.
Representative Garrett?
Excuse.
Representative
Stringer? Excuse.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Shields?
Excuse.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Stiegler?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnett?
I'll give an aye vote with the understanding that I will probably oppose this.
All right, that's fine.
Chair Barker.
Aye. LC 2725 is adopted. No further business before the committee. Committee's adjourned.